Hello and welcome back to the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark and Mark here talking about all the latest news in Formula One, everything that's dropped since the season finale at Yas Marina last weekend, the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. And we are now at the beginning of a very long, did I mention long off season? But it is kind of like that feeling that you get. Sort of, that it's like starting the work week. This is like the Monday of the Formula One off season compared to when you get to the beginning of the Formula One season. That's got that Friday feel to it. But hey, we'll persevere. Are you hanging in there so far, Mark? Are you going to make it till March?
Yeah, I am. I actually feel a little bit differently. Like, I'm looking at this calendar, and we're basically 94 days out from Australia. And you know what? Given the fact that we have to pack in a compressed winter testing, like, I have a feeling this is going to go by super, super, super fast. That said, I think emotionally, psychologically, it's probably going to be a pretty dark, grim winter for all of us. But hopefully by the time we get to Australia, you know what, the rate of vaccination will have increased. And I think people's spirits will have started to lift a little bit. And maybe, you know what, Australia will kind of be that mark, that inflection point where fans are coming back into the stands and we're starting to get some of that atmosphere back. And it could be a really entertaining season. But yeah, for me, like, I look at this calendar and I'm almost panicked at how quickly this is going to turn around because the season ran so late this year. And you know what, I think we probably want to enjoy this break for a couple of months, because next year, when we're covering 23 races, it's going to be unlike any season we've ever seen before. Obviously, new races, doubleheaders, tripleheaders, it's going to be a crazy calendar.
Well, if you think about it, if we keep up the schedule that we've been doing this year with the weekly show and then the Sunday night wrap-up shows, that's 46 podcasts next year. So, wow. Oh, sorry. I'm not even counting that. That's 52 for 52 weeks plus the 23 races. I was just thinking, 23 races in 23 weeks. And then, you know, it's getting late here.
I just realized
there's not 23 weeks in a year. There's actually 52. But yeah, wow. There's a lot coming down. But it's good, too, because the World Motorsport Council this week has actually approved the 23 race calendar for the 21 season, with the April 25th date of, that was going to be the Vietnamese Grand Prix, but that has been scratched, sadly. I mean, that was going to go this year, then it got canceled because of COVID and everything like that. So, like I was saying, it's Thursday night, 9:30 here Pacific time on the west coast of North America. So by the time this episode drops, we're like almost exactly half a day behind the European news cycle. So what we're speculating on now is probably all going to get confirmed by the time most of you are listening to this. But some of the speculation that we were talking about, or what we were speculating on before we hit record here, was just some of the possible venues that might slot in nicely. I mean, the one that's been mentioned recently is Portimao that would come in, and then you'd have let's see, we'd have Australia, Bahrain, China, and then from China we would have gone to Vietnam, to Hanoi. Obviously that's off, but then I was thinking, I guess ultimately, Mark, like we were saying off air, it's going to come down who's going to put up the most money and who's going want to pay the most for a hosting fee. But certainly, I mean, there are a lot of contenders that were there, and a lot of these, if you want to call them temporary or fill-in venues that we saw races at this year, did very, very good jobs. I mean, I really enjoyed Mugello. I really enjoyed Portimao, enjoyed Imola, the Nürburgring, but those are kind of like known quantities. But Portimao is one that gets thrown around. And certainly if you go and check out some of the social media from some of the F1 journos, that they're preparing for a busy Friday, and we're just waiting to see what the confirmation is going to be on that race number 4 in that 23 race calendar, which is cool too, because when I heard that Vietnamese Grand Prix had fallen off, it wasn't going to happen, I was kind of wondering, hey, maybe this just they're just going to leave it blank, and then we're going to have like a 4-week mini break a month into the season. But glad that's not going to happen.
I think you know what's funny? I had the exact same thought. Like, it's 22 race calendar is already pretty aggressive. Like, that's what we were expecting to see for 2020 prior to COVID causing sheer chaos. But I thought 22 was already a pretty aggressive race calendar. But I guess the way to look at this is, until recently, there was still an expectation that Vietnam was going to join. And, you know, we could talk about that for probably an hour or two, and the fact that it fell apart for some very domestic political reasons. And as it turns out, that the politicians Commission and the authorities that were really driving the impetus and the energy behind hosting a race got pulled into some politically exposed scandals, and ultimately the race kind of fell apart, which is a shame because the infrastructure was in place, mm-hmm. the track and the circuit was ready. It looked like it could be really fun to watch, but ultimately didn't happen. So it kind of made sense that, hey, do you really need that spot on the calendar? But I think based on what we saw this year and the reduced revenues that Liberty and Formula One and the FIA would have experienced as a result of the pandemic, and you know, ultimately we talk a lot about the fact that Formula One really generates revenues in one of three spaces. One, it's hosting fees from tracks and race organizers. It is sponsorship, both team and kind of overarching umbrella sponsorships, and it's also TV money. And last year, despite the fact that they raced in a lot of places in Europe, they really weren't recovering anything in the terms of hosting fees for those races. Ultimately, those races were being staged so they could recover as much TV revenue as possible as they could from Sky and ESPN and their other broadcast partners. And ultimately, that made sense because if I'm a track or if I'm a race organizer, I'm not going to pay you, Mr. Formula One, anything to host a race because I can't recover that because I can't sell tickets to this event. Yep. So I think a lot of this is, hey, look, we need to recover as much as we can from last year and start banking some of that cash. And I think it's probably unclear at this point just when we'll start to see fans at the venues. I think we'll probably see in the early part of the season, we'll probably see reduced capacities, and we'll probably see something like, obviously the local health authorities will be a big part of this, but one of the really fantastic good news stories coming out of New Zealand and Australia right now is their COVID case count is effectively zero. And knock on wood, if that continues, it's possible that maybe they, you know what, they sell out the track and they have 100,000 people on race day. And then we'll probably see that number gradually ramp up as the season progresses and more people have access to the vaccine and things like that. But I would say that probably by the summer, midsummer, when you're partway through that European calendar, I think we're going to see some pretty big audiences. But yeah, 23 race calendar, it makes sense to me that they're going to be as aggressive as possible. But the other thing to consider too is while Spain is on the calendar for that May 9th weekend, that race isn't a lock because they still haven't agreed to a contract with the race and the host organizers in that country. And it's also kind of funny because Spain wasn't supposed to be on the calendar last year, and it kind of got a reprieve because of the COVID situation, and they needed a track on the calendar. So it was kind of a surprise to me that it's back again this year. And they seem to be these one-year short-term deals, but it's nice because I think it's good. But I think as well, from a marketing perspective, if you're going to be bringing Alonso back, there could be a really compelling reason for the race organizers to shell out the 20 or 40 million euros to get the opportunity to host a race. So yeah, 23 races next year should be pretty darn exciting.
Absolutely. And just to follow up on that thought for Barcelona, the one thing that they're also doing is that they're reworking Turn 10. So I mean, would they really go through all that design and engineering and construction work for, you know, if you're not going to have a big event like a Formula One race? Totally. So that's one thing. But I was also thinking too that it's interesting now that the World Motorsport Council has ratified and finalized and approved this 23 race calendar. I was thinking, you know, every year this is kind of creeped up. They've added a race here and there over the past several years, and they keep saying that they want to get it up to 25, which is basically bang on half the year. You're racing every other weekend all year long. I mean, of course, you're going to have more compressed times because it go from like March till December, right? However, I think that now that we have, 23 races confirmed, I think it's going to be a real good test, at least logistically. I mean, we'll just have to kind of put the hosting part and fans in the stands. That's a separate side issue just based on the COVID thing. But just logistically speaking, how the feedback that they're going to get from the teams and just the infrastructure just to host and get these races going, just the strain that it's going to put on these different organizations just to host them. So that's going to be fascinating to watch. And it's interesting too. And we are also talking to it's interesting also how you have you kind of hop back and forth in that beginning part of the season. You go to Australia, then you go to Bahrain, then you go to China, and then we're thinking we're probably looking at Portugal and then Spain, and then you have like one quick flyaway weekend to Canada, which is counted in the European season. Then you're back after Canada, after Montreal, you're going to Monaco, and then you're really into the thick of the European season, and then that basically runs until the beginning of September, because usually the summer break is bookended by Hungary on one side, and then you get Spa and Monza at the end of August, beginning of September, then it's off to Singapore and places like that afterwards. But it's interesting because we were discussing the possibility of when could they, or is there like any drive to reschedule Montreal? Because typically what you have in the fall is after you have a couple of those races, like in the Far East, you have Singapore and whatnot, then you come back, you go to USA, you go to Mexico, then you go to Brazil, and you get, then you also have, you do one jaunt over to Japan as well. You're kind of like jumping around a little bit. But whether or not they can maybe reschedule that, I guess one of the things has to do, of course, with the track availability and whatnot. But Canada is kind of the funny one that's kind of sandwiched all by itself there, you know, at the beginning of the season when you have USA, Mexico, Brazil right at the end of the year. And we were talking about the possibility of maybe trying to find some sort of way to line it up. But then I was thinking about how when you remember at the beginning of the year when COVID hit, it was just okay, like Australia's canceled and then they're canceling Bahrain. There was kind of like this rolling kind of like cancellations before they finally said, okay, everything's canceled and then we'll look at starting it. And so Montreal was one of those races that was confirmed to be canceled at one point, and they did discuss about maybe trying to host it later on in the year. And it was interesting because I don't remember the exact date, but it was something to do because Montreal can get pretty cold in the winter. But they were saying, I think it was about the middle of October, they said if you get anything beyond that, it just wouldn't be possible or practical to host a Grand Prix at that time of year. So I guess that is a bit of a constraint there, because usually it's always interesting because you have the Mexican Grand Prix always falls pretty close to the end of end of October. It's always in and around Halloween, and USA is a week before. So who knows? Certainly lots of cool things coming up with the calendar. They've also confirmed the host, or what was it, the fees for next year as well, the entry fees. So they've been really busy. So that all the teams were required to pay $556,509 before adding in their weighted totals before I love that, I mean, there's obviously a reason that they decided on $556,509 and then, then they have to add, there's more fees on top of it, basically adding up all the points that you are awarded or you win in the constructors every year. So Mercedes ends up paying $6,677 per point, which on the face of it sounds pretty expensive, but you think that they more than recoup their money in Formula One just from what they win and all the exposure. And I'm sure that that old saying, win on Sunday, sell on Monday, is very applicable to Mercedes. I don't think there's any lack of customers buying those cars, their road cars anyways.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you made a really great point, and I should have mentioned this myself, but when we talk about the aspirations of Liberty, and we talk about the fact that we're going to have this absurdly aggressive calendar of 23 races this year, they're very open and transparent about the fact that their end destination is a 25 race calendar, to your point, and we would effectively be racing every other week. And, I talked to some people last winter that are a little bit closer to Liberty and have a slightly better understanding of what they're modeling out in terms of their economics for the future of the sport. And the way that they see this working is the calendar would basically be broken out. We see this a little bit so far, but the calendar would really be broken out into segments by geography. And rather than having these scattered flyaway races, you would have flyaway blocks. So we have a North American block. So we're going to be in Montreal, we're going to be in Miami, we're going to be in Austin, we're going to be in Mexico City, and then ultimately we're going to be in Brazil. So you basically carve the planet up into these blocks, and then you would have a Middle Eastern block, and you would have an Asian block, and you'd have the European calendar. Because I think that logistically, I think it would be too much to expect a 25 race calendar to be as scattered as it is today. And it's reasonably well segmented today, but I think they would need to do more. And make no mistake about it, race 24 is obviously going to be Miami. Liberty has done everything in their power to make that happen. And they obviously had some really wild aspirations for a downtown track on the causeway initially. And locals, owner associations, and the neighboring condo buildings were going to have none of that. So ultimately, the race was from a design perspective, moved out to the suburbs to Miami Gardens and to be raced around the facility where the Miami Dolphins play. But make no mistake, race number 4 will be in the United States. And race number 25, if Liberty has their way, will be in the Western Seaboard of the United States, which could conceivably be good for us because it puts us a race a little bit closer at hand. But yeah, race 24, no questions asked, will be Miami once they can make that logistically happen. But that also just reinforces how valuable having that kind of North American segment in the calendar would be. But I think I've bored most of our listeners with my wild speculations and rants about a conceivable calendar in the future.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention Miami, though, just before we go into the break here, Mark, because I was thinking about when you brought up, you were talking about Hanoi just a little earlier in the show, and I was thinking, well, how disappointing that is to lose that race. But that was kind of one of those races that's kind of talked about almost in parallel with the Grand Prix in Miami, and how that's really encountered a lot of different hurdles along the way. Yeah. And not that I have a really, you know, vast or deep knowledge of civic issues in Miami, but just based on the issue that David Beckham has had with his Major League Soccer franchise, this is a story I covered at length on my other podcast, which we started way back in 2013. That was one of the first things we talked about when we started that show, was you know, Beckham bringing an MLS team to Miami and all the issues that he had trying to secure land to build a stadium there. He had all these different places picked out, and, you know, It ran into different issues and different hurdles, you know, both the opposition from local residents and from city council and, you know, just all the, you know, the bureaucratic hoops. So eventually he found a site and a situation that worked for everyone, which is the way that it should be. So the long story short is that I think that this race in Miami will happen. Obviously, there are bigger issues at play right now in terms of the pandemic, but I think it will happen at some point, but I think it's just going to take a while before it's all sorted out and they get it to, you know, to a point where they can, you know, they find a situation that works for everyone rather than, you know, having people that live to next, I was going to say Pro Player Stadium, but I guess the totally. Dolphins Stadium
Hard Rock.
I guess I'm kind of
like, had so many Joe Robbie Stadium. Yeah. Pro Player. Yeah. It's had many, many names. So, no blame. And the one thing I would encourage people to do is if you want to get a better sense of, and I'm really glad you brought this up, but if you want to get a better sense of the local opposition to racing, not only downtown, but at the Miami Gardens location, is take a look at where the proposed track is and look at it in proximity to residential detached housing in the neighborhood. We're talking, in some cases, 100 feet from somebody's home. Like, what they're proposing is, I don't want to suggest it's outrageous, but I think it's going to be very, very challenging them for them to put that race where they want to put it, especially when you consider the fact that anyone who flies in for this race will be downtown. They'll be staying downtown. They'll be eating downtown. They'll be shopping downtown. And really, they'll only be funneling out to the Miami Gardens area for the race. But take a look on Google. It's pretty interesting, and you'll get a sense pretty quickly of why it's going to be challenging for those race organizers to make that race happen.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, time for a break here on the Overtime Media Network. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And Mark, time for more speculation now as we try to...
That's what I do best.
Yeah. Well, also try to run the clock and stretch it out. Hopefully something breaking pops up on our monitors here as we go through the show. Yeah, keep hitting the refresh button. But one of the other things is Red Bull is set to make a major announcement today on Friday. And I think we can pretty much read between the lines here what it's going to be. And, you know, if there's any smoke or any fire with that smoke, is it's a confirmation of Sergio Perez as the second Red Bull driver for next year. So the big question will be, well, how long is the term of contract going to be? He had hinted before the season was over that he had plans in place for 2022. So does this mean he's going to get a one-off deal with Red Bull for 2021? Or does it maybe mean that he's got another drive lined up for 2022? Who knows? Maybe it's something like a one-year plus an option. So we'll find out. But when we wake up to tomorrow morning, check our phones before, you know, our feet even hit the floor to find out what the story is. But this seems to be a pretty much, I don't want to say the worst kept secret in Formula One, but it certainly seems like pretty much a foregone conclusion. I mean, they were saying earlier this week that Albon's future would be decided before Christmas. And then, you know, the news coming down on Thursday about this press conference or this announcement that they got scheduled for Friday morning. It's kind of like, you know, read between the lines, do your homework, you know, check some of the things that are being said by some of the F1 journos out there that you can kind of reach your own conclusion on this one.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway for me, and for some reason, despite the fact that you and I have been talking and speculating about this move for forever, is I never really considered what the contract length, what the term could look like. And it was only today when I was kind of reading some of those breaking news articles that I saw that the speculation is that it's going to be a one-year deal. And again, we don't know. Well, you know, tomorrow morning when I'm blurry-eyed scrolling through Instagram at 7 in the morning, then I'll be able to start processing what it actually was. But, you know, I think that's pretty interesting for a driver of his age. And to your point, like maybe he had something on the back burner for 2022. But I thought it was interesting that this is a one-year deal. Like he has very little security in this situation. And mm-hmm. You could argue that he's going to have the opportunity in the second best car on the grid. And I don't think you could really dispute that's the case given where Ferrari is currently. But 1 year doesn't provide a lot of security and it doesn't provide him with a great deal of opportunity to get to know the car, his engineers, the mechanics, the team and the strategists. So hopefully he can adapt quickly because my sense is that if he doesn't do well and Yuki has a really great year keep saying Toro Rosso, but AlphaTauri, then, you know, he could be on the hot seat as well. And it's this constant churn of drivers on the top tier at Red Bull. But obviously I hope he does well. I hope he's got a backup plan for 2022 if he's going to sign up to a one-year term.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I've sort of been churning this one over in my head the last day or so, I was just sort of thinking, okay, well, let's say that Perez gets the seat now, and then, you know, Albon is out for sure. And then you kind of look at the list of drivers that they've kind of gone through in the past couple of years, because I don't want to suggest that Ricardo leaving was acrimonious or anything, but that obviously that relationship had expired. He felt, regardless if it was sort of overtly feeling pushed out the door, it didn't really feel like that way, but he must have, obviously felt the direction that the team was going to be Max Verstappen centered, right? So he could see the writing on the wall. So then you kind of start this rotating door now, this revolving door with Gasly, Albon, maybe now Perez. And, you know, honestly, you know, if, well, I mean, you can even throw Danny Kvyat into that mix too, if you want to go back to 2016. So, I mean, now you kind of look at this broader Red Bull picture with the big team Red Bull Racing and then AlphaTauri/ Toro Rosso, that if you're a young driver in that Red Bull Academy, you got to be thinking, okay, well, if I'm coming into AlphaTauri or something like that, you got to think, okay, well, it's great to be in Formula One, you know, if I can play my cards right, you know, maybe I can get a shot with the big team. But I'm kind of thinking now, is that really, it's maybe not the situation you want to be in, because I think they're sort of establishing themselves a bit of a reputation now, or a bit of a, Yeah, I don't. I'm not even sure what the if reputation is the right word, but I think you know what I'm trying to get at. There's sort of you know, with all the different changes that they've made there, I don't know if that's that sort of real pipeline to Formula One superstardom coming up through their academy, through AlphaTauri to Red Bull, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to end up in good things unless you have the prodigious talent of Max Verstappen.
Yeah, I think you used the correct word. I think reputation is probably the appropriate sense. And to be fair, they're earning the reputation because people like you and me and the media journalists like to talk about these things. But, you know, if I'm a young driver and I'm being recruited by an academy, whether it's the Ferrari Academy or the Mercedes Academy or the Red Bull Academy, I just need to look at the way that they've treated some of their younger drivers over the last couple of years. You know, you look at the trials and tribulations of Kvyat, the fact that he was on the senior team, demoted, bounced out of the organization, mm-hmm. brought back, bounced out of the organization. And you look at that the Albon saga, and even though they gave him an entire calendar year or a calendar year and a half, like there's no question that he wasn't being nurtured the way that maybe a young driver should have. And you can look at the experience that Gasly had, which is he got half a year at the big team before being demoted. Like I think it would be challenging for them to recruit and retain young talent now, simply because this is a team that was well known for many years for being really driven. I hate to use that as a pun, but they were really driven by developing talent internally rather than depending on the mm-hmm. open market to recruit and sign established racers. And obviously they were able to do that because they were able to develop drivers like Sebastian Vettel, and they were able to develop drivers like Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen. But now all of a sudden they're gravitating away from that philosophy by bringing in a driver like Sergio Perez. And they've clearly mishandled a number of their young drivers over the last 4 or 5 years. And even when you look at Daniel Ricciardo, at the end of the day, that was a relationship issue, and I don't know that it was salvageable, but they also created the environment that allowed it to get to that point. Mm-hmm. So you, even when you develop a really great, mature, charismatic driver, they weren't able to keep him. And I got the sense, you know, Daniel Ricciardo's done some really great interviews recently where he talked about when he called Christian Horner and said, hey, you know what? So I'm gone. I'm going to go to Renault. And Christian Horner laughed because he thought he was joking. But it also speaks to how disconnected the senior leadership within that organization was from where Daniel Ricciardo was mentally. So I think you're right to kind of just put a bow on this. I think they're developing a very real reputation amongst young drivers for sure.
Do you think maybe that this possibly sets up in the future some sort of Jerry Springer type talk show where former Red well, Bull drivers like, confront Christian Horner? You know, flying chairs it. And, you know, swearing and all the whole nine yards.
You could literally have Kvyat and Ricciardo and Gasly and Albon sitting on a stage talking, I was going to swear, talking the S word about Horner and Marco. And then like, guess what? And a door swings open exactly. And they walk out onto the stage. Oh, it could be
Jerry.
So good.
Jerry, I can see it right now. This would be great. You know, if they want to go down the reality TV path with the Drive to Survive, which is fantastic, they got to do the Jerry Springer one as well.
I totally agree.
All right. Well, let's try and pull this one back on on track here. So the other thing is interesting that may play out over the next week or so before Christmas is Lewis Hamilton perhaps could end up with a new new contract because he did comment earlier this week that he wanted to get a new contract done before Christmas. Anyways, he had you know, there have been a couple of things out there on social media. You know, he's planning to be at Mercedes next year. He says he wants to be there, and you know, so he's really hinting at it. You know, quite overtly that things are in the work. And you have to remember the last time that these guys sat down to get a contract hammered out, it took like less than a day, and then they ordered pizza at the end. So, you know, which seems like a very un-Formula One kind
vegan
of thing.
Vegan pizza, to be clear. It was
vegan pizza. Well. There yep. you go. But I couldn't really see them going to Domino's or Pizza Hut or something
exactly,
like that. But
exactly.
yeah, I mean, certainly, I think that this is a relationship that has worked fantastically well. I mean, when you rewrite the record books in, you know, basically every single category that you can think of, both as a driver and a manufacturer, if both parties are both keen to continue, the desire's there, why would you not just from that point of view want to do it? And I mean, I've said it so many times. We we talked about it probably even last week, that Lewis is now at that that point that he can walk away from Formula One on his own terms whenever he wants. But at that time, you know, obviously it's his right, you know, to stay here, and you know, as long as he's happy to be there and he's still a competitive driver, you know, why would you not want Lewis Hamilton in your team? And I think that's that's a no-brainer, because of course, if you know, they were not to you know, renew that deal, who would they replace them with? I mean, I know George Russell's somewhere putting his hand up saying, you know, I'm available, but still, this one, I for me, this just seems like such, again, I don't want to say it's a completely a foregone conclusion, but it just seems like it's just going to be a matter of time before this announcement comes out that they got a new deal between them. And again, I think the big question on this one is how long and how much?
You know, I think one of the things that typically comes up at a point like this is you reflect back on the last 6 or 7 years and you talk about the fact that he's a 7 times world champion and he's won 7 driver's titles with Mercedes. And then people tend to speculate and hypothesize, well, you know what? Anyone could have won those titles in that car. And I'll be honest, like I feel that if you put another talented driver in that seat in 2013, that it's possible they may have won a couple of titles. And you know, we saw Nico Rosberg win a title in this car, but I think ultimately Hamilton just won all of them. Like he's indefensibly the best driver in the sport now. And again, Formula One's just so unique when you compare it to other sports because of the dynamic of the car and the team and the engineers and all of those kind of pieces. But my sense is, you know what, I still believe other drivers would have won titles in that car. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone else was winning 6. I don't think anyone else would have had the domination that Hamilton had. I don't think anyone would have been reliable as Hamilton. And you just think about Hamilton as a package, right? And I get criticized for this all the time. Like, oh, you just call him the GOAT and you don't look at his flaws and you don't look at his deficiencies. But I'm like, if you look at the last 6 or 7 years, what have his flaws been? He's won 6 titles. He was points away from winning the 7th. Like, and he never steps a foot wrong off the track. He's charismatic. He's a total pro when it comes to dealing with the media and when it comes to dealing with fans. He is a total pro. And the other thing is, from a marketing perspective, he's the only truly transcendent personality and driver in the sport. He's the only one that is bigger than Formula One and can be recognized beyond the track. And I think that's important in North America because you and I are really insulated. You know, the casual sports fan probably has no understanding of Formula One. They might know Lewis's name. They mm-hmm. might know Michael Schumacher's name, but they won't know anything more than that. But that's impressive because he penetrates popular culture in a way that no other drivers do. So when you couple all that together, like, he's a pro, he's charismatic, he wins, he doesn't make mistakes, he never puts a foot wrong off the track. Like, it's a no-brainer. And I think for Mercedes as well, with an organization as big and rich as that one, like, I think to your point, it's going to be a quick conversation. It's like, hey, what's it going to take? What's a fair amount? And I think at some point too, I think it's going to go beyond simply his salary as a driver, but that if he's going to continue on in this relationship with Mercedes, I think the conversation contractually steers towards other things. Mm-hmm. And it's either stock, it's partnership in long-term marketing campaigns, it's involvement in design. Like, I think his future with this organization is probably going to be pretty rich, both financially, but just in terms of his involvement with Mercedes as a whole. But honestly, what have they got to lose? This guy's won you 6 titles, almost 7 titles. He's won you 7 constructors titles, never steps a foot wrong. He's a transcendent superstar. Open the checkbook and pay him.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of really great points that you bring up there. I mean, if they made Nico Rosberg an ambassador for Mercedes, what are they going to make Lewis Hamilton when he decides to call it a career, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the ambassador to me just doesn't cut it for a guy that's done what he's done for that team and that organization. But also, I think what's interesting, you mentioned it too, that one of the things that has made him so good since 2014, and his entire career for that matter, is just his consistency. I mean, I totally agree on the point that if you put another driver in that car, they might win a championship or a couple of championships, but they're probably not going to win 6. And you know, we've talked about it quite a bit recently. Just the discrepancy between Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas. If Bottas was more consistent between, you know, the green light and the checkered flag, at the end of the year, he's closer to Hamilton in terms of Hamilton versus Rosberg than he would be, you know, just basically hanging on by tooth and nail to stay ahead of Max Verstappen in the Drivers' Championship. I mean, not to take away anything from Max. I mean, just to be in that conversation by the time we got to Abu Dhabi, you know, in light of the fact he had 5 DNFs this year and had a real rough patch there during the middle of the summer, I think is, you know, says a lot about the season that Max Verstappen had. But yeah, I mean, the consistency that Lewis has is one of the things that really impresses me. I mean, there's a lot of different things that impress me about Lewis Hamilton, but it's just the fact that whenever he needs to put that hot lap down, or he it never seems to fail. I mean, when push comes to shove, he's money. You can always bank on Lewis to do what he needs to do. But I don't know if you saw it. Did you see that picture of him? I don't know. I can't remember now if it was on Twitter or Instagram. He might have double posted it. It was something that he kind of, with the bedhead. Obviously, he's, you know, not looking as neat and tidy as usual. He kind of was like, you know, rocking the fro. I was just kind of thinking, well, hey, you know, if you don't have to do anything, you're on holiday right now. It's like, if you got it, flaunt it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so the next one that I wanted to talk to you about, Valtteri Bottas, you know, just to sort of like, just sort of grow on what we were just talking about here, says that finishing second in the Formula One's Drivers' Championship can't be all that satisfying. We'll talk about that in a moment after we take another break here on the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One, so don't go away. All right, well, we're back. And Mark, just before the break here, we were talking about, Lewis Hamilton for quite a bit, and then we were just started to broach the subject about Valtteri Bottas, who said that it can't be satisfying to be second runner-up in the Drivers' Championship. I mean, he was only, what was he, like 9-10 points ahead of Max by the time the season was done. Anyways, Valtteri had the following to say, quote, "As a driver, when you're in the best team overall this season, being second can't be that satisfying, but it's something to be able to contribute to the team this season, getting us the fourth constructors title for me and the team and seventh in a row for us. It's better than being third for sure. I guess I will get a small trophy to take home next week at the FIA prize giving. I'm sure when I'm old and gray, I can look back and say, yeah, I was second, but hopefully I'll get a bigger trophy one day." That's kind of an interesting one, don't you think? it seems almost a defeatist quote, but it seems somebody that almost seems resigned and kind of very, maybe very aware of where he really sits in the pecking order. I think he's very cognizant now of where he fits into the big picture.
It's maybe shocking that it took this long, but it's funny. When I was reading those quotes, I thought the exact same thing. Like, well, this is he sounds very defeated. And I think the challenge is, this isn't the first time I've heard these quotes coming out of Valtteri Bottas. Like, it's been pretty consistent for the past, not even the past couple of months, but you get to a point during each season where he starts to emote like this.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the honesty and I appreciate the transparency, but I don't know if it's necessarily good, because it creates an opportunity for you and me to talk about things like this, and for other podcasts and other journalists to kind of write these stories. You know, that said though, like, I wonder too, like, I try to put myself in that psychological state of mind where you're part of a team, but you're always second fiddle. Like, there's always this one person that's winning and winning. And so, like, you're working in an office, you know, with this other guy, he's always executing these awesome projects that your coworkers are rushing around and high-fiving him, and you're doing good work, but you're not getting recognized. And that your coworker then submits a bid for a big contract and he wins the contract and everyone celebrates and they're high-fiving him, and you're still doing good work. And like, I wonder how long, like, for me personally, that's probably not something I could do forever. And for him, I just wonder, like, what is his psychological state? But then you read these quotes and like, it's pretty clear what his psychological state is. He's feeling pretty beaten up. But at the same time, how much of that is self-inflicted when, you know what, your teammates wins 11 races this year and you win 2 in the same car, if you know what I mean? And again, it's a good partnership because it's delivered how many constructors' titles since he's been there? 17, 18, 19, 20, four. It's good because he's really great at defending Lewis and giving Lewis the opportunity to win. But it's alarming that he's emoting so publicly about this thing that we would probably all speculate about if he wasn't saying it. And again, I don't know what the I don't know what his solution is. It's either you become a better racer and you start competing with Hamilton, which you haven't shown the willingness or capability to do over the last 3 years, or you change your situation. And if you change your situation, you're not going to be in a championship contending car. So it's tough. And I'm kind of curious from your perspective too. Like, you read these comments, they're very defeatist. He's emoting pretty publicly. Like, how does that resonate with you as kind of a member of the media and a fan? Like, where does that take you in terms of your perception of Bottas?
Well, it certainly is very interesting because, like you say, I mean, we've heard him say things like this before, especially like after the 2018 season, which was a bit of a rough one for him. I mean, he came back last year, was fired up when the first race right out of the gate in Australia. But I'm kind of wondering, this seems to me to have like a little bit of a different tone to it. I mean, the content is similar, but when you see, you know, what George Russell came in, and I know it's only one race, it was only one weekend at Bahrain too for that Sakhir Grand Prix, but I mean, George came in and into a car that he wasn't familiar in, he didn't fit into, you know, I mean, there was and he went out there right from the, you know, FP1 all the way through that race, and if it wasn't for a couple of things that were completely beyond his control, George Russell was absolutely a lock for the podium and had a legit shot to win that race. And that's the problem, I think, that maybe Valtteri Bottas is facing now. And perhaps if we didn't have COVID, if Lewis hadn't gotten sick and he hadn't missed that race, because he'd never missed a race before this, you know, this season for any reason, that this wouldn't have been a conversation that we were even having 3 weeks or a month ago. But this is where we're at right now, and I think that you know, some of this is getting kind of real for Valtteri, and he's maybe kind of asking some of these hard questions to himself, and I think maybe he's starting to realize it a little bit, that you know, it's one thing, because I mean, all these elite athletes, they have this similar mindset, you know, if I just go out, compete, if I train hard, if I, you know, follow my nutrition and all these things I need to do, I can go out there and perform at my best, I can do what I need to do. And he obviously left a lot of points out on the track this season. Now, is that, you know, some of it's going to be his fault, some of it's going to be, you know, for issues that are on the car, and, you know, the occasional thing that are, you know, that just happens, you know, it might be a mechanical issue, or, you know, somebody drives into you. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can happen. But I think for me, the big difference between Bottas and Hamilton was really highlighted in that Turkish Grand Prix. I mean, they're driving the identical car. I know he had a bit of floor damage, but still, I mean, I can't remember. Did Lewis actually lap him in that race, or did he get close? He did. Yeah, that's what I thought. And I thought, well, you know, if you're in the same car and, you know, you're sort of in that sort of mindset that I should be challenging my teammate for the world championship, even though that was the race that he kind of sewed it up. That, you know, that was really highlighted by that. But it's interesting too, not just this quote, but some of the quotes that we've seen that, you know, just even recently when he said, even before Sakhir, that he said, well, it won't look great for me if George Russell comes in and does better than me this weekend. And, you know, he'd made sort of some similar comments, you know, just highlighting that, you know, that whole Turkish Grand Prix and that whole situation, which I think his car exchanged, you know, driving direction, was it 6 or 7 times he spun out in that race? So there's a lot of things, and, you know, and again, we talked about it last week or the week before, just this rolling 1 year contract that he's had at Mercedes since 2017. And, you know, with a hot young prospect who's already in the Mercedes system, like George Russell, gosh, you know, it's if I was Valtteri, you know, I don't think it would be a bad idea to have my agent starting to look around for options for 2022. Who knows what's going to happen with George? I mean, he's obviously going to be at Mercedes, or sorry, at Williams next year. That wasn't a slip, because I know something. George obviously at Williams next year. Mercedes has confirmed Valtteri for another contract for next year. But it really makes you know, next year's silly season, you know, really something to speculate and talk about.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing he isn't helping himself with, he's not doing himself any favors by sharing these quotes.
No.
This isn't helpful. You are a world-class Formula One racer in the best car, in a historically good car. Like, it doesn't reflect well on you from an emotional and a psychological perspective. And I think ultimately this probably resonates into the team a little bit, where if you're the mechanic and the engineers working on his car and you're reading these quotes, like, where's his state of mind? Has he quit? Has he given up? And then I think it's also pretty clear that Formula One, probably more than a lot of team sports, is a very, very mental sport. When you're on the track, you know what, you're confined to that cockpit, you're fighting the elements, you're fighting the heat. So much of what's happening around you is mental, and it's kind of, it's decision making that has to be made in a nanosecond. And if you don't have the right state of mind, you're going to make mistakes on the track. And, you know, a single mistake can cost you a race. Like, this, it doesn't look good. And if I'm his publicist, and I don't know that he has one, but if I'm his agent, for sure, I'm going to get in his ear about this, because ultimately, you know, if you don't have a long runway with Mercedes, you're limiting your options with other teams with these kind of quotes. You know what? You celebrate your team's success. You know, I want to do more. I want to do better. I'm going to work hard in the offseason, all that, I hate to say that, but that cliche quote unquote hockey talk, like, just spoon feed the media. Don't give them this kind of fodder to dig their teeth into and talk about. It's not becoming, and it's not helpful for your career.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was kind of thinking that, you know, if he just sort of keeps his mouth shut, I mean, I don't think that's going to be something that, you know, is going to make Toto Wolff want to push him out the door. But certainly, like you say, I mean, if you're one of the guys working on his car, you know, you're in the garage there, it kind of makes you wonder where, you know, where is he, you know, he is mentally, right? But I mean, as long as he doesn't drive into Lewis Hamilton, you know, or get into, like, you know, something, you know, like we saw Nico Rosberg do, you know, a couple of times, several times, then I mean, he's still that ideal teammate, because I mean, he's a known quantity within the team.
Absolutely.
And you know, and that's what Toto and the team are going to love him for, because he's going to win some races, which, you know, makes him feel good. But he's going to help score all those important points in the championship in the constructors, and extend. You know, I just kind of wondering, you know, how would they you know, the inventive hashtags that they use for every championship, what would they use for eight? But you know, maybe we can talk about this this time next year. But yeah, fascinating to watch. Now, just talking a little bit now further down the grid, well, one spot down the grid, so Red Bull is saying that the possibility of having an engine freeze is making them more hopeful that they can work some sort of deal to keep you know, keep the Honda engines after next year and take that over and develop them themselves. Now, we haven't really talked about this too much, but I think this would be a really good thing for Formula One. As bad as it is, or negative it is, that Honda's pulling out, and I completely understand their reasons for doing so, I like the idea of a team like Red Bull being able to, you know, become like a pure manufacturer, in the sense that they're developing and designing, building cars, but also engines. But having said that, I know that's a very massive commitment, both in terms of design and manufacture and financials. It's a big commitment. And I know that there have been some quotes coming up from some of their rival teams that haven't been overly warm or friendly towards the idea of the engine freeze, but perhaps that's softening now. But I think this would be a good thing. I would hope that something can be reached, and that when Honda is gone after next year, that you know, they just don't turn off the lights in the factory and the design shop, and, you know, just lock it up and then put all the stuff out in the recycling bin, and that's it, right?
Yeah, the good news in this case is ultimately that the heavy lifting is done. And I don't want to sound too cliche, but I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen manufacturers like Volkswagen or the Porsche group, or possibly a Ford or a Chevy or some of these other manufacturers enter Formula One, is the upfront sunk cost of developing one of these highly complex engines is absurdly expensive.
Yep.
And I think if not for the fact that Honda has done the groundwork in developing this platform, and obviously they were able to refine it over a number of years with McLaren, and then they were really able to polish it off with their last couple of seasons with Red Bull / AlphaTauri, I don't think they would be in a position to do this. So I think what ultimately they want to be able to do is they want to be able to take over the IP, take over the manufacturer of the engine, and just kind of continue on the progression that they're already on. That the challenge is, it's not economically viable for them to do that if the sport was to tear up the engine regulations in 4 or 5 years and start over again. Like, I think they and a lot of teams want to understand that, hey, you know what, we're going to have a fairly static engine formula for X number of years, because ultimately the most expensive component of these highly complex and extraordinarily expensive cars is the power unit. But that, again, and you know, I spent way too much time on Reddit, and you start to go down that Reddit rabbit hole. But I think ultimately this engine probably does have that 4 or 5 year runway. We'll see it through 2026. After that, I think there's all kinds of questions, because I think we start getting, and I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think we start getting into a point where globally, we start inching towards this point where individual nation states have all but outlawed or prohibited the sale of internal combustion engines in road cars. And then all of a sudden you have this championship racing series that is effectively using antiquated technology. And I know the sport has all sorts of energy around biofuels and things like that, but I think for the next 4 or 5 years, obviously it makes sense if they can get that IP from Honda. And of course, there's all sorts of speculation that by bringing Yuki into the AlphaTauri team, obviously they're doing the Honda team a kind of a solid, but I think Yuki's a reasonably good driver, probably deserves that seat anyways. But yeah, it's a fairly complicated situation overall, and something we could probably spend a couple of hours talking about.
There we go. Off-season special number one is already it's already decided itself. Yeah, but joking aside, it would really be cool, and it is amazing just how long it took Honda to really get up to speed. You know, to use a bit of a pun there, because I mean it. They were behind the design curve compared to where everybody else was when they came in with McLaren. We all knew that there was going to be a time before they really got their act together, really figured it out, and got those engines to a competitive place. But those were some pretty dire years, and I have to give a lot of props to to Formula One for managing to convince Honda to stay in Formula One, because McLaren, remember, they bought themselves out of that deal. The cost, what was $100 million or 100 yeah. million pounds or whatever it was, the first window of opportunity that they had, they took it, and then they moved over to Renault, which has been a good stopgap for them. I mean, they've been a little bit more competitive. They've gotten a little bit better each and every year, and that team is going to be one to watch going forward. But having said that, it's disappointing to see Honda pulling out at this point. And I guess the big question is, and you just hinted at it, is long term, is what are the new engine specs going to be like in 2026? And then how long are those going to stay in effect for? And it really sounds like that they're going to try and extend and perpetuate this in some form or another. Like you say, they got all these exotic biofuels and things like that, and ultimately that's I think going to have a lot to do with it. And I think eventually, whether they like it or not, they might be forced into electrification. And maybe what they're just doing in the meantime, maybe they've realized that internally, and they're just trying to maybe prolong that move as long as possible, to the point where electric power and electric cars could be a lot closer to what we see right now with the in Formula One, without regressing too far back. So who knows?
The one thing I'll add on that as well is we talk about how disappointing it is that Honda is departing the sport. By all accounts, within the board at Honda in Japan, this was a highly contentious issue, and it ultimately took a senior executive casting the deciding vote to decide that it was the right time to leave Formula One. Like, this was never a foregone conclusion. And I think that was a company that was deeply divided over whether they should leave. And you're right. Like, don't forget, it was only a decade ago that Honda had a factory works team, and they left the sport at the height of the global economic crisis. And it's something of a surprise twist move. They came back 4 or 5 years later, but they came back purely as a power unit supplier. But the engine formula was vastly different than what they were conditioned to with their Milton Keynes-based organization a couple of years prior. Not Milton Keynes, Brackley-based organization a couple of years prior. But I'm really happy to see where they are now. And it's sad that they're leaving, but I think purely from a business perspective, it doesn't really make sense for them. They're not the works team. They're not the banner team. They're just the engine supplier, and they're never going to get that top billing that they would as a works team. But at the same time, you're talking about an upfront startup cost of $1 billion to build your factories and do that. And again, for a sport that's changing, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's sad to see them go because they have so much positive history, yeah. But at least in a sense, they're going out on top. You know what I mean? They've got a competitive formula once again. They're winning races. They won the most recent race in Abu Dhabi. So at least they can leave on top in a sense.
Yeah, it's going to be fun next year to see what they can do with Red Bull on that final season. And, you know, if they have a good year, then Red Bull obviously have a lot of reasons to be really optimistic going into 2022.
Yeah, absolutely.
If, you know, if there's the engine freeze and the new cars coming in, everything like that. Anyway, so a time for one final break here on the show. And when we come back, we've got a couple more interesting stories to talk about. And we're going to start with McLaren saying that third in the Constructors' Championship is about prestige and not money. So we'll talk about that on the other side of the break, so don't go away. All right, well, welcome back to the show, everybody. And yeah, we'll start to wrap it up now before we dim the lights and go home here. Well, actually, you know, there's nowhere else we can really go right now. We're all home. We've been here for months. We're all dying to get out. I guess that's a bad word to use considering the situation. We're eager to get out of our houses again and go and do other things. Anyways, like I said before the break, Zach Brown, CEO of McLaren, said third of the Constructors' Championship is more about prestige than any financial win or benefit that they got from that. But come on, at the end of the day, the payday still is a good thing to have.
Yeah, I agree. And I think ultimately, you know what, 2 months from now, when no one will ever remember who was third in the championship, ultimately what they'll remember is that they were able to bank a certain amount of cash, which they desperately need to continue developing these cars and things like that. And I get it. It's nice. Like, it's good for us to talk about the fact that, hey, they were third in the championship, but it took some really mitigating circumstances for them to be there, right? It took a 15-point penalty to Racing Point, and it also took a catastrophic horrendous year by a historically bad year for Ferrari. Like, Ferrari hasn't been sixth in the championship since, what, 1980? So there's some mitigating circumstances that helped to elevate them there. But ultimately, I think Zach Brown's a likable guy. And I think you and I talk so much about what he's done and what he's contributed. And the fact that they were able to excel despite all of the financial pressures that they've been facing over the last couple of years. And we talked even last episode about the fact that they've had to take out a big loan with a Bahraini bank, and they're leaning into heavy investments from a U.S. conglomerate. And they've had to sell the McLaren Technology Center just so they can lease it back. Like, they've had to do some extreme things to stay solvent. So it's really nice to see that, hey, third in the championship, you know what? They can say whatever they want about it being kind of a mark of accomplishment. But at the end of the day, the single most important thing to them and their accountants is the cash that comes with that third place finish.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it is it's absolutely good validation for the work that Zach Brown has done over the past several years, and also the work of the people that he's brought in to help run that team and keep it going and bring it back. Because you can almost feel, despite all the things that they've had to do, like you just mentioned, off the track, just to keep the business solvent, to keep the money flowing and all that sort of stuff that they need. But despite that, you can almost feel the morale radiating from the Formula One team. And I think that they're going into a really interesting place now, going into 2021, because this partnership with Renault is over. They're getting the Mercedes engines back. They're off, obviously a third place finish in the Constructors' Championship. They're going to have a very good lineup of drivers next year with Daniel Ricciardo and Lando Norris. I think also a pretty good pair of marketing-wise. I think Carlos Sainz has done a very good job for McLaren over the past couple of seasons, as has Lando Norris. But I think that that slowly but surely they've done some really important things, both in terms of people, both on the track and off the track, sort of out of the car, in the car, if you want to call it that. But also, I think getting the Mercedes power again is really a huge win for them. And it's going to be one of those teams that I'm going to be watching keenly next year. I mean, it's just been a fascinating story to watch. A, how bad they got so quickly. I mean, it's not all entirely their fault, just because of the reasons we were talking about before the break, just with just where they were with the Honda power unit at the time. But also equally, how almost equally quickly they've rebounded and come back to a place of respectability. I mean, they when it was dark, it was a really, really dark place that they were in. But to their credit, they've turned it around in fairly short order and in not easy circumstances, might I add.
Yeah, one of the things that's really remarkable about this as well is they did the transition from the Honda power unit to the Renault power unit. And that's not an easy transition, right? Like you fundamentally build your car around the power unit. And if you swap power units, you effectively have to rebuild the entire car to accommodate the weight and the balance and the dynamics and all the different aspects of that power unit. So the fact that they were able to do that is remarkable. And it's also pretty well regarded amongst Formula One teams that Renault isn't a great partner. They will sell you an engine, but they're not going to give you much more than a crate on a pallet on your shipping dock. Whereas Mercedes, on the other hand, is typically very well regarded as a partner. Like, you know what? You're going to buy engines and they're going to provide ongoing support and they're going to staff you with full-time engineers. They're going to give you ongoing support. They're going to take analytical data back and give you feedback. Like, they're a very good partner. So I'm really excited to see what McLaren could potentially do with an even better power unit provider, let alone the power unit provider that keeps winning championships themselves. And, you know, looking at the driver's title championship here too, the one thing that really impresses me about McLaren is they've never looked for a shortcut when it comes to cash and drivers. They've never leaned into that concept of the pay driver. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They could have gone down the Nikita Mazepin path. Like, we need cash badly. We're gonna compromise the integrity of our team and the quality of our drivers for that cash grab. They've always done the right thing by choosing great drivers, and they choose good young drivers, and they choose competent drivers that are well established with other teams. And then even the fact that they made that effort to go after Daniel Ricciardo, not necessarily knowing what their future was going to look like, because when they brought Ricciardo over, they weren't yet committed to Mercedes and their future path wasn't that clear. But the fact that they're still willing to spend money to bring in top tier driving talent is also a real mark of integrity for that team, because given where they've been financially, they could have fallen into that Haas trap of signing somebody who's bringing cash but doesn't necessarily bring a great deal of marketability or charisma or integrity. But they've just been doing everything the right way, if you know what I mean, from the top down. So I'm happy to see the successes they've been having.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be fun to watch next year. And I really think that's going to be an interesting driver pairing that they're going to have with Norris and Ricciardo, two obviously pretty good drivers. And I think for me that Lando was impressed right from his very first season in Formula One. For me, though, I think the one race that really stood out for me was the French Grand Prix in 2019. Because remember, he was hit with, was it a hydraulic problem just with a couple of laps left in the race? And he struggled with the car, and he still came home and got a couple of points out of it. And it would have been easy just to, you know, maybe just give up and retire the car. But, you know, all credit to him. I mean, he hung on and he was able to you know, claw his way or just hang on just by tooth and nail just to get that car across the finish line. And I think, you know, I'd been impressed with him before that. But I think that was one of those moments when, you know, at the French Grand Prix, when I thought, okay, this guy's legit. And I think for me, he's really sort of I think he's gotten better and better all the time. And, you know, Carlos Sainz, you know, I think he's a decent driver, but I think that what they're losing in him going to Ferrari, I think what they're getting in Ricciardo is just as equally a good driver. But also, I think maybe more importantly for the PR people at McLaren is a marketable guy, a guy that's got real charisma. I love Danny Ricciardo. You know, he's always got a big smile on his face. He's candid. You know, he seems like a very down to earth and regular kind of guy. I mean, when I see Danny Ricciardo, I hear him talk, I'm like, I don't know what it is. It's just like a guy I feel like I can relate to for whatever reason.
My goodness, you've absolutely nailed it. I can't, like, the marketing team for McLaren must just be salivating at the part. Like, Carlos Sainz, nice guy, good kid, gets along well with Lando. He's personable. He's okay in an interview. He's not necessarily marketable beyond that. Daniel Ricciardo, both on the track and off the track, is just like a wet dream for a marketing team. he's got a grin from ear to ear, and he's got jokes for days, and he loves being in the interview. He loves being the spotlight. Like, he's just amazing. Like, every time I see an interview or a podcast with Daniel Ricciardo, I go out of my way to listen to it, because one, you learn something new. He shares a lot of information. He comes from a great family. Like, just from a marketability perspective, this is going to be a windfall for that team. For McLaren now to be able to go out and sell sponsorships ships within that British market based on the fact that, hey, we're an up-and-coming capable team that finished third in the championship, and we've got a past race winner, Daniel Ricciardo. Wow. Great yeah. job to them. Great move.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're in a really good place right now. And not to mention that I think that that papaya color that they have on their car, that traditional McLaren color, is one of the most recognizable and one of the best colors on the grid right now. As much as I love the silver of the Mercedes and the scarlet of the Ferraris, you know, that papaya looks really, really, really good too. So that's, you know, yeah, they got a lot of good things going for them. Really looking forward to seeing what they can do next year in beyond. And Mark, just before we go here, there was a couple of things that were interesting. First of all, we kind of glanced over this one at the beginning of the show when we were talking about races and the schedule for next year. But this is something that was out a month or two ago, and I had a tweet from one of the listeners. I forget who it was, but it was a Brazilian fellow who said even then that that they were still talking about a 5-year deal for Sao Paulo at Interlagos. And you know, the one thing that sort of comes up repeatedly when I talk to people about that they seem very positive about it, keeping it Interlagos, but I've had a lot of negative feedback about people, you know, from people, other fans that have been very, let's just say, not enthusiastic about the prospect of building a new track at Rio de Janeiro, just because the amount of construction, the amount of things that they'd have to do, the amount of trees they'd have to cut down, the environmental impact. And so I think this is a good one. You know, it's obviously not a modern track, but I really like Interlagos. I think it offers a lot. And I mean, there's been some memorable races there over the years. So I think this is a win. I think this is a good one to have that race extended with a new deal for another 5 years.
For a country like Brazil that suffered probably more than most developed or developing nations over the past 10 years from an economic perspective, it never made sense to me that they would front the capital to build a new track when they have a perfectly serviceable Formula One track already. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It never economically made sense to abandon Interlagos to move to another city and carve a new track out of the countryside. One, because the sport was getting a ton of blowback because they were going to intrude on some pretty sensitive ecological land to do it. But two, because this is a country that's facing some pretty serious economic headwinds. And I think we all saw the economic fallout of hosting the Olympics and the fact mm-hmm. that there was significant economic fallout of the fact that immediately following that, they hosted the World Cup. And ultimately, this is a country that has misplaced its financial resources pretty significantly. And I just thought optically, it seemed like a really poor decision. And I was really happy that we're staying at Interlagos. And you know, if you have capital and you want to invest in Interlagos and you want to improve that track, both for the drivers and the spectators, that's great. But I think as a racing circuit, it's very good. Like I love the elevation changes. I love the layout. I love everything about it from a driving perspective. And you know what? Pretty consistently, we see rain as well during that time of the year and that type part of the world. So we get some pretty exciting wet races as well. I never understood the impetus to move. The one thing that I thought was very interesting, and I think this is very much a veal dig at the politicians and the business people that were leading the charge to relocate the race, is it's going to be renamed. It's no longer going to be the Brazilian Grand Prix, right? It's going to be the Grand Prix of Sao Paulo. So I thought it was interesting that not only does the rival city lose out on the opportunity to secure an F1 race, but the Brazilian Grand Prix is actually going to cement itself as the Grand Prix of Sao Paulo. So I thought that was all very, very interesting. But yeah, I totally agree. It never made sense to me. And Interlagos is a grid track. And if there's capital available, why not just reinvest it in this current track? The drivers love it.
Yeah, especially Max when it rains, because that 2016 Brazilian Grand Prix, was that an awesome race. I mean, Max, yep. I mean, he was passing people in that race in the wet that people don't pass on when it is dry. I mean, that was amazing. Yep. But I guess that is Max Verstappen. But I kind of had to chuckle here, and I'm going to be a little bit facetious, because, you know, when they got some blowback about the, you know, the ecological impact and the environmental damage of building this new track, I kept thinking to myself, it's just like, you know, somewhere in Formula One, there's a, you know, people are going through social media and they're like, oh, we're getting a lot of negative feedback on this whole Rio de Janeiro track and stuff like that. So, oh yeah, well, let's release this announcement of the new race in Saudi Arabia. That's here we go. You know, right? So anyways, that's just me being facetious. But anyways, just to close it up, apparently there's a new lighting system out that could, you know, extend or bring the opportunity to host more night races for Formula One, which I think is cool, but do we need more night races in Formula One? What's your two cents on that one?
Yes, yes. And principally because it means I don't have to get up at 6 a.m. to watch a race that starts at 2 p.m. in Western Europe. So I think for selfish reasons, you know what, if they can push those races back to 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock and I can watch them at a reasonable time, our time, that's good. But you know what? I still like date. You know what? I don't know how I feel about this. Maybe I don't really care, but I kind of like that the night races that we have, there's something special about
yes.
them. And because there aren't many of them, like Bahrain, it makes sense. It was originally a day race. It's now a night race. The track looks beautiful. The lights sparkling, the LED lights wrapped around the palm trees. It looks beautiful. Abu Dhabi's beautiful because it's kind of a dusk race that graduates into a night
yep.
race. And then Singapore as the first night race is beautiful because you get to see the skyscrapers sparkling and Marina Bay sparkling. Like, I like it because it's special, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you know, that pretty much echoes my sentiments as well, because I thought that my first reaction to it was, okay, that's cool, but is that maybe too much of a good thing? And
yeah.
for those exact reasons, I mean, I like all those three races for the exact reasons that you mentioned. And it's just like, could it be too much of, take away a little bit of the uniqueness of those? I mean, if you added one more, sure, why not? I mean, but like you say, I mean, from a selfish perspective, because I mean, a couple of weeks ago for the Sakhir Grand Prix, I mean, we were watching that one here on the West Coast when we were having our breakfast on Sunday morning. So from a timing point, it was perfect. I mean, that's why races like Australia and Japan, like in those parts of the world, they work so good, because those are races that, you know, we can stay up, because they either come on late in the evening or maybe in the early hours of the you know, what's technically morning. But it's doable, because, you know, for a person like me who's a bit of a night owl anyways, I can stay up and watch a race even if it's after midnight. But for some strange reason, I can't drag my butt out of bed at 6 a.m., especially on a Sunday, to get up and watch Formula One. I mean, I can record it and on the PVR and watch it a couple of hours later, but it takes a little bit away from the experience of watching it live. But you know, I think I'm pretty much neutral on this one. I could maybe go for another race, a night race, but you could add too many to it, and that would kind of take away a little bit of the specialness of it, if that's even a word. But it's getting late here, and I've pretty much gotten to the end of what I wanted to talk about. So if I'm making up words now, then hey, I'm just going to do it, because it's been a long day. Anyways, shall we wrap it up there? I think that's a good place. So we're going to be, well, don't worry, we're not going anywhere. There'll still be a show coming out over the holidays. And until then, if you want to get in touch, please do so. We love the tweets, love the emails. So send us a tweet at ScuderiaF1Pod or email us at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's a wrap. Happy holidays. Enjoy the holiday time. And we'll talk to you guys again very, very soon. Bye for now.